Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. Today we'll be talking with best-selling author Carl Hiaasen, whose newest book for young adults is Skink, No Surrender. We'll also hear from Michael Ross, whose new book is The Great New Orleans Kidnapping Case. And Jennifer Edwards will tell us about the big read at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Carl Hiaasen is one of the most beloved of best-selling writers. He's the author of many wonderfully satirical thrillers set in his native Florida, as well as nonfiction collections of his journalism for the Miami Herald, and books for young readers such as Hoot, Scat, Chomp. And today we're talking about his most recent book, his first for teens, called Skink, No Surrender. Carl Hiaasen, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
Oh, I'm so happy to meet you, and congratulations. Skink, No Surrender was nominated for a National Book Award recently.
I know, that I was as shocked as everybody.
Now, surely not. So I want to know, you've had such a terrifically successful career with your thrillers and your journalism, and what was it that made you turn toward writing for young readers?
Well, it happened years ago with a book called Hoot, I guess what they call for middle grade. That was a case of an editor coming to me, you know, after I'd written a number of grown-up novels, including Striptease and others, and saying, well, have you ever thought about writing for kids? And I said, are you out of your mind? Have you not read any of my other stuff? Why would you want to expose the youth of America to that? And she said, you know, kids love funny books. They're big into the, you know, the sort of the environmental themes and the irreverence and the humor. And she said, why don't you give it a try? So I went ahead and did that book really with the idea that was going to be the only one. I was going to write a book that I could give to my stepson and my nephew and nieces, and then I'd be done with my familial duties, you know. And then that Hoot took off and you know, got the Newbery Honor and everything. And I was as flabbergasted about that as I am about the Book Award nomination. But here's what happened is I started getting this mail, and it continues to this day as I keep writing these kids' books, just enormous amounts of mail from kids, wonderful letters, funny and sharp and just as cool as you can imagine. And every one of them, almost everyone ends with, when are you going to write another book? So it's been an audience that I just can't say no to, and so that's why I continued to do it.
Well, the young readers are almost more demanding than the older readers. And they'll write you and tell you.
And they're very blunt. And if they like one book better than another, you'll hear about it. And the other cool thing is they often do some artwork and send you, and they've just got the best lines when they write. And I try to answer every single letter, you know, that I get from the kids in particular.
Well, thank you. That is admirable.
They're a lot more enjoyable than some of the newspaper mail I get, which comes with crayon labels from prisons, those kind of things.
So while Hoot, Scat, Chomp, and Flush are aimed at younger audience, middle grade readers, Skink, No Surrender kicks it up a bit for teens.
Well, it does. I mean, I don't really think about the categories. I wanted to introduce this character, Skink, this crazy, you know, one-eyed ex-governor of Florida, who had appeared in several of my grown-up books, starting with Double Whammy way back in 1987. And he's one of the more popular characters. I hear about him from readers all the time, and I kind of like him, and I bring him back occasionally into novels. But my youngest son, who just started high school, you know, was old enough to read one of the grown-up books, and he loved Skink. And I thought, well, maybe this is a character that kids would dig. You know, I mean, he's really out there, but he's got a good heart, and he's a rebel, and he's a crusader, and all that kind of stuff. He had some heroic qualities, flawed but heroic, and so I said, I want to write a book introducing Skink to the younger audience. But I didn't think about, you know, teens. But as the storyline developed, and in this novel, it involves a girl who meets a guy online and turns out to be a bad dude, and she runs away with him. So it was a little more serious, heavier subject matter than some of the other kids' books. And so my editor said it would be a better teen book, and that's fine with me. I mean, I just really set out to write a story. I didn't say I'm going to shoot for a new market. It's the last thing from my mind, but it made sense as the storyline developed.
Well, and it makes sense as a reader, too. You know, if you track your family's reading life, your kids go through phases and they hit awkward ages where the words might be appropriate, but the storyline isn't, and they want to graduate. And so I think it's kind of smart to go from Hoot, Scat, Chomp, and Flush to Skink, No Surrender. And then they'll be ready for the next books.
You know? Yeah, you know, but again, the one thing about young readers is they're just amazingly loyal, and they stick with you. And it was, again, the last thing I thought about when writing these kids' books. I was just really thinking of that time and place in your childhood, and I never thought that they sort of track you and they stay with you as they get older as well.
Now, whenever I talk to anyone about your work, it's like 6 degrees of separation. It takes no time for Skink to come up.
I know.
It's like, don't you love him? And so he's been in 6 books before, starting with Double Whammy, as you said. And this is the one that's, you know, all about him for young readers. So tell us a little bit more about this character and how he came to you. And I have to say, he makes the best entrance in this book ever.
Yeah, I don't want to give it away.
No, don't.
He's big on making a grand entrance.
Yes.
But you know, when I was my second novel that I'd done by myself, Double Whammy, it was really a twisted little book about murder and corruption on the professional bass fishing circuit, which territory I pretty much had to myself in the literary world. But I needed a hermit guy. You know, this is how sophisticated. There was a scene where I needed a kind of a guy living in the woods who was a little bit eccentric. So why not make him a former governor of Florida, an actual honest politician who went to Tallahassee and went stark raving mad because of all the corruption and just ran out of the governor's mansion one day, ripped off his clothes, and disappeared into the woods. And that was the little backstory that I came up with because it seemed to me a very logical reaction to Tallahassee in general. And so he was just going to be around for a couple chapters, and he had a very small function originally in that novel, but I liked him so much, and he started saying and doing these things that were very interesting and entertaining to me, and I was writing it. So I left him around, and sure enough, he sort of becomes the whole moral compass of that book, and readers love the guy, and I don't usually bring back characters. I don't often do it. But I brought him back in a couple of other books, and I had the same reaction. So he's sort of been in this enduring, eccentric, and sometimes derailed figure in the books. And just, I like him. I have to admit, I like him myself.
Well, Skink is so visually striking with his shower cap and his wild hair and his very white teeth.
Yeah, he's got great teeth, and it may be the roadkill diet. He doesn't believe in wasting anything, so if there's a roadkill rabbit or something, he cooks him up. It's just an odd little detail that I threw in there for humor. And then I started getting all this mail from, I didn't know there was this roadkill cult in this country. People sending me recipes and anecdotes, and even once someone brought a painting of a roadkill to one of my book signings and presented it to me very proudly. So it opened up a very weird world. And the first thing I tell young writers when I talk to young writers is, whatever you do, don't write about roadkill. Don't go down that road, so to speak.
Oh, man. We've been talking with best-selling novelist Carl Hiaasen, whose new book is Skink, No Surrender. You can meet him Wednesday, October 15th at 6 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much, Carl.
Thank you, Susan. I look forward to New Orleans very much.
Michael Ross is an associate professor of history at the University of Maryland, but before that move east, he lived in New Orleans and taught at Loyola University. That affection for and interest in New Orleans comes through loud and clear on every page of his new book, The Great New Orleans Kidnapping Case, Race, Law, and Justice in the Reconstruction Era. So welcome to The Reading Life, Mike.
Hi, Susan. Good to be here.
Oh, this was a fascinating case that took place during a turbulent time in New Orleans history. Set the stage for us, would you, of Reconstruction New Orleans in 1870?
Yeah, the case opens in June of 1870, which is the height of radical Reconstruction in New Orleans. And you have a 28-year-old Republican governor from Illinois whose legitimacy is questioned by all the people who opposed Reconstruction. And he's convinced that he can win over converts to the Republican Party with an economic development plan. But it's also the moment in New Orleans where the police force has been integrated, the legislature has been integrated, African Americans are serving on juries as politicians in the government, and many former slaves had moved into the city after emancipation, and there is a large portion of the white population who is angry at a world that they see turned upside down.
And into this cauldron of civic change, there's a terrible kidnapping case. Tell us about this case.
In June of 1870, Molly Digby, the daughter of Irish immigrants who lived in the back-of-town neighborhood that was where the Superdome is today, is abducted by two African-American women. And normally, this abduction would just be one of the many crimes that took place in New Orleans that day, reported in the city intelligence columns. But the rumor soon circulates that because St. John's Eve is coming up, when voodoo practitioners had celebrations on Lake Pontchartrain, that the child has been abducted for the use as a voodoo human sacrifice. And when this rumor hits the newspapers, the case suddenly becomes sensationalized, and the white press starts to focus on this case as the type of thing that's happened now that the state has been, in their words, Africanized, and they predict that an integrated police force would not solve this crime. And some of the leading white women of New Orleans, the wives of some of the most famous cotton factors and financiers, now will make this case their own and go to the Digby's house in a neighborhood they normally scrupulously avoid it. And they march to the house of the Reconstruction Governor, Henry Clay Warmoth, demanding that he do something to solve the crime. And Warmoth, who wants to prove that his integrated police force is up to the task, takes the bait, puts up a major reward that's going to make this case the Powerball of the summer of 1870, but also has his police chief, Algernon Sidney Badger, put his best black detectives on the case to prove that they could solve this crime.
Now, one of the characters that will most fascinate readers is that detective, Jean-Baptiste Jourdan. Tell us about this detective and his work. And this was a moment when we were beginning to be aware of detectives, wasn't it?
That's right. The first detectives in the United States began in Boston in the 1840s. And by the time of the Digby case, they had become, through the short stories of Edgar Allan Poe and others, through magazines like the National Police Gazette, had become the most glamorous figures in law enforcement, where the police had previously mostly been used to prevent crimes. Now, detectives on the police forces were using deductive reasoning and looking for telltale signs and going out in disguise in efforts to solve crimes. But what makes the Digby case different is that some of the detectives in the story are African-American. These are the first African-American detectives in American history. Jean-Baptiste Jourdan will become the first to make national news. And they'll be carrying lots of symbolic weight with them. If they succeed, they will be proof that African-Americans can serve in these roles and do it effectively. But if Jourdan fails, the critics will point to this as a sign of a police force that is not up to the task. And again, five cities in the South had integrated their police forces during Reconstruction, and this is way ahead of the North. In the North, you're not going to have the integration of police forces in many cases until the 20th century. New York doesn't integrate its police force, much less have black detectives, until 1911. So this is all happening in the South and not the North, and essentially the whole nation is watching in the newspapers to see how this will turn out.
So what is it about legal history that draws you? You write these painstaking, detailed books that take years of research and writing. What is it that keeps you engaged?
Well, legal history, I always think, is a very precise window into the past, in part because you can always read about what people said their society was about, but when you read the laws of a society, it gets to the heart of the matter. If you read the South Carolina Slave Code, any claim that slavery was a benign institution evaporates immediately as you read the draconian punishments that are handed out for even the most minor offense. The other thing that legal history has that's so wonderful are the trials. And when you read a trial transcript, or in many cases where newspapers have recorded verbatim everything that happened at a trial, suddenly all of these people that otherwise would have been lost to history, kind of your anonymous people of day to day who somehow become entangled in a court case, suddenly come back to life. And you have this wonderful window into the past. And then you have juries who could be incredibly unpredictable at all times. And the combination is a really kind of fantastic window onto a vanished world.
Well, I have to tell you, I read this book as if it were John Grisham. It's a real page-turner. It makes you see the city in a whole different way. I mean, when you describe how it takes 9 hours to get from one place to another, you start to go, oh, God, I see that. You know, it was really fascinating in every way.
My hope here was exactly that. That it's one thing to read about Reconstruction history in a history textbook and hit all the major events. It's another to look at it as it was lived day to day. And I tried to write this book to make it an immersive experience where you feel like you're on the ground at the time. And through the window of this kidnapping case, all of the other issues of Reconstruction play out, and I have my characters getting on the streetcars and going to the restaurants and so on in hopes that you say, okay, well, this is what it would have been like to be grappling with the issues of Reconstruction at that moment.
Well, every now and then, you know, a book comes along. Sometimes it's fiction, like Josh Russell's Yellow Jack, for example. And sometimes it's a book like this one, and you do feel for a while that you're reading that you are walking around in the New Orleans of the book. I mean, it makes that old city shine through in a really compelling way, and you've certainly done that with this. We've been talking with Michael Ross, whose fascinating new book is The Great New Orleans Kidnapping Case, Race, Law, and Justice in the Reconstruction Era. You can meet him Thursday, October 16th at 6 at Octavia Books, or Friday, October 17th at 5:30 at Little Dizzy's on Esplanade Avenue, where many of the descendants of the families involved in this case will be in attendance. Thank you so much, Mike, and congratulations.
Thanks, Susan.
Jennifer Stearman Edwards is a trained lawyer turned self-described arts warrior. She's here in her capacity as Director of Advancement for the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, which is planning to take part in the Big Read, a nationwide reading initiative sponsored by the National Endowment for the Arts. The book that SOFAB has chosen for this year is The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck, and that's what we'll be talking about today. Jennifer, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us a little bit about The Big Read.
So one of the focuses of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum has always been education and literacy around food. So we applied for the grant through the NEA, the Big Read, and we're fortunate enough to be one of 77 institutions throughout the country selected, and we're very happy to have been selected.
So what factors went into considering the Grapes of Wrath and finally settling on it?
Well, we felt that it had some resonance through the Gulf South. We are, of course, interested in understanding and learning about food. The Grapes of Wrath has to do, in part at least, with what happens when people are separated from what sustained them. Their livelihood, in this case, was farmland. And it, of course, has to do with horrific weather conditions, giving rise to the Dust Bowl, and also with greedy corporate farming practices and so forth. And we see a little of that, we felt, perhaps with the BP oil spill. In that case, it was the sea, not the land, but there were many, many people who were deprived of their livelihood. So we felt that it would be something that would work well with our own mission, and also it's a beautiful, beautiful work of literature.
It struck me reading it this time, because I went back and read it last weekend, and it's not an easy book to read in a weekend, you know?
No, I know it's not.
But it also speaks to this rapidity with which people can slip through the cracks. So tell us a little bit about the plot for people who haven't read it.
Well, the Joad family are tenant farmers in Oklahoma, and they are driven from the land because it became unsustainable for the owners of the land to make any money when they had actual tenant farmers there because of the Dust Bowl. the land had simply dried up, and instead of rotating crops, they continued to keep planting the same thing over and over. So the main character, Tom Joad, has been released from prison, goes back to find his family, and learns that they have taken off to go west to California, where they think things will be better for them, which is what happened with a lot of people. And in fact, they weren't all that much better. But it's really an odyssey of the Joad family and what happens to them as they try to regain their life. But I think it has to do a great deal with the resilience of the human spirit and what strength people have. It's also very much a matriarchal story with Ma Joad. And there's violence. There's a lot going on in it, but it's also, it's a good read.
And it's been, of course, made into a film. It's been in Bruce Springsteen's songs.
Right.
It's had a long life in the culture.
It has a cultural iconic status by now.
So the reading period is 1 month, from October 14th to November 14th. What are some of the activities you've all got planned?
Well, we have a kickoff party at our new facility at 1504 O.C. Haley Boulevard, which was the former Dryad Street Market. And we're calling that Days of Dust, but we're going to have a string acoustic trio that will be playing Depression-era music. We hope they will come up with some Woody Guthrie songs, of course.
Of course.
We will have discussions about the Depression era diet and food, and Liz Williams, our director, will be speaking about the novel and about food of that era. We're also going to be participating in a panel discussion at the Louisiana Book Festival on November 1st, 2014. Dr. David Barris, who is a professor of anthropology at University of New Orleans, a cultural anthropologist, will be delivering our keynote address at the Jefferson Parish Library, the East Bank Regional Library, which is one of our partners in the Big Read. We're also screening The Grapes of Wrath, the John Ford movie, with Henry Griffin of University of New Orleans. Also are having a canning demonstration at the French Market. So because that is something that definitely was happening during the Depression when nobody had any food or had less food than they needed, we'll be doing a canning demonstration. We are also screening the Dust Bowl documentary, the Ken Burns documentary, at the New Orleans Public Library's main branch. And our final event will be a little different. It's called Pouring It Out, and it's a lecture by Elizabeth Pierce, who is a cocktail historian. And we're going to tie in the Depression and Prohibition and the historic relationship between that, because there is some economic thinking that Prohibition didn't help the economy any too much. And so she's going to be coming up with some beverages that will address that and tie in to the themes. And once again, it will be a discussion of the novel as well.
But you know, once you get into this book, it really does kind of sweep you along. I was amazed to see how quickly I raced through it. It was fascinating. So how can people get involved?
Well, one of the things that we're doing as well, and I forgot to mention, is we're going to be having a food drive, and we'll be collecting food for Second Harvest Food Bank. Anyone who goes to any of our events, we hope, will bring some canned goods so that we can help out in that way. You can go on our website, www.southernfood.org, which we'll be having a list of the events. But the Big Read's website has everything listed right now, and that's www.thebigread.org. But we hope that people will start reading the novel and come along to all the discussions we're going to be having and see what they can bring to it as well, because the novel is a good read.
We've been talking with Jennifer Edwards, who's the Director of Advancement for the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. They're sponsoring the Big Read October 14th through November 14th and have chosen John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath as their title. For more information, go to southernfood.org. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you, Susan. I enjoyed this.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Joy Wilson signs Joy the Baker, Homemade Decadence, irresistibly sweet, salty, gooey, sticky, fluffy, creamy, crunchy treats. Tuesday, October 14th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Carl Hyacin, signs Skank No Surrender, Wednesday, October 15th at 6 at Octavia Books. Wayne Parent discusses and signs his book, Louisiana Field Guide, Understanding Life in the Pelican State, Wednesday, October 15th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Michael Blumenthal signs The Greatest Jewish American Lover in Hungarian History, Wednesday, October 15th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Keith Weldon Medley discusses and signs Black Life in Old New Orleans, Wednesday, October 15th at 6 at the 1850s House, 523 St. Anne. Sally Asher discusses and signs Hope in New Orleans, a history of Crescent City street names, Thursday, October 16th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. This is part of Coffee and Conversation, sponsored with the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library hold their semi-annual Big Book Sale Thursday, October 16th to Sunday, October 19th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are 10 to 8 Thursday through Saturday, October 16th through 18th, and noon to 5 Sunday, October 19th. Today's guest, Michael Ross, signs the Great New Orleans Kidnapping Case Thursday, October 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Dr. Ron O'Gorman, author of Fatal Rhythm, and K. Bark Hinckley, author of Birds of a Feather, discuss the literature of belief Thursday, October 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Timothy Duffy discusses and signs We Are the Music Makers Thursday, October 16th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop, along with Little Freddie King and Alabama Slim. Duffy also signs Friday, October 17th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop with Major Handy performing. The Southern Food and Beverage Museum kicks off its big read of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath with a party Friday, October 17th at 6 at the museum, 1504 O.C. Haley. Jervy Tervelon signs Monster's Chef Friday, October 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses The Circle by Dave Eggers, Saturday, October 18th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Anne Byrne, the cake mix doctor, signs the Anne Byrne Saves the Day cookbook Saturday, October 18th from 8:30 to 10:30 at the Crescent City Farmers Market, 700 Magazine Street. The Scholastic Writing Awards sponsor a Write at UNO workshop Saturday, October 18th and Saturday, November 15th. These will be in the UNO Writing Center and will go from 9:30 to 12:30 in the morning. Attendees receive a free copy of Scholastic's Best Teen Writing of 2014, a book of winning entries from last year. Submissions for the awards open September 15th. The deadline for submissions to the awards is late December. For more information, go to gnowp.org. Ryan Adams signs New Orleans Mother Goose, Saturday, October 18th at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. The New Orleans Museum of Art and the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans celebrate National Reading Group Month with Readings Round the Big Easy, Saturday, October 18th from 10 to 5, featuring Tulane professor Molly Travis discussing the history of book groups in New Orleans, and authors Anne Benoit, Amy Connor, Laura Lane McNeil, Michael Moffitt, Michael Petrie, Katie Simpson-Smith, and Rebecca Snedeker, along with representatives from area book groups. Free with no admission except for the afternoon tea with authors, which requires advanced registration. Check out noma.org for info. Deborah Dixon of Bell Books is the guest speaker at the meeting of the South Louisiana chapter of the Romance Writers of America, Saturday, October 18th at 10 at the East Baton Rouge Library in Metairie. In conjunction with Friends of New Orleans Public Library, Little Free Libraries all over New Orleans will celebrate the third anniversary of Little Free Libraries here, Saturday, October 18th from 2 to 4. Check out littlefreelibraries.org for a map of all 17. Lee Bardugo signs Ruin and Rising, Saturday, October 18th at 5 at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.